Yes, we have 5 members on the platform so far, with the exception of Honorable Boshoff and Honorable Tafeni that have apologized.
Oh, okay. No, thanks. Maybe let's formally then start the meeting. Let me formally open the meeting and welcome Minister Patel, honorable members of the select committee, the staff of the committee, staff of parliament, in particular the constitutional and legal services office, our guests, PMG and other media present in the meeting. As you indicated, the apology of Honorable Boshoff, she indicated that she is going to be having an IO procedure, but fortunately, it's just a small procedure. She will be again available in the plenary session this afternoon. We wish her well. We also wish her Honorable Tafeni, speedy recovery. We also received the news of the passing away of Professor Sefdel, the father to the executive director of NEDLAC. We pass our condolences to the Sefdel family. But today also we remember the passing away of the father of democracy, His Excellency President Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, who passed away on this day 10 years ago. As we will be getting a briefing from the minister, when we were approached, it was indicated that the two bills were to be introduced to the committees or to parliament. I felt that it was impossible, you know, at this late stage.
Recording in progress.
But then I was reminded of the words of the late president, who says it is always seems impossible until it is done. With those quotes, I will hand over to the minister. Welcome, Honorable Minister. Now, I'll be handing over to you. You will also indicate the delegation that you will lead. Thank you so much. Over to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And good morning to you, Chairperson, and good morning, honourable members, as well as the staff of the Select Committee and staff in the department. I am joined by the DDG, Evelyn Masocha, as well as the staff from the Ministry and the department. I think honourable members will know Tulu Mushi, and you will also know that Saroj is on the platform. And Desmond Ramabulana from the department. Chairperson, honourable members, thank you for the opportunity to present to the Select Committee on the Companies Amendment Bill and the Companies Second Amendment Bill, and to provide some information to members of the committee on the rationale for the two bills and to expand on some of the provisions of the bills. My office has circulated the PowerPoint presentation dealing with the bills on a clause-by-clause basis. I will be making some introductory remarks, Chairperson, and then we'll refer the committee to the presentation itself. Honourable members, company law is important in any economy as it's a body of law governing the legal form, the rights and aspects of the conduct of firms and companies in an economy. It also specifies relationships between parties involved in a company. For example, relationships affecting shareholders, members and directors, and increasingly it also deals with other stakeholders. The concept of a company or a corporation involves a body of people who have a common economic purpose. And this idea, Chairperson, can be traced back thousands of years back in human history. The Dutch East India Company, which spearheaded the colonization of large parts of the world, including South Africa, was a body of merchants granted a special charter by the Dutch state. Legal scholars see the modern corporation as a body of people that are authorized by the state to act as a single entity. Now, of course, today, not by a special charter, but through a law of general application. And such a corporation or such a body of people would be recognized in law for the purpose of acting together in the economy. In South Africa itself, company law can be traced back to at least 1861, beginning with the Joint Stock Companies Limited Liabilities Act of the Cape Colony, which according to research that was conducted by the DTIC, was a carbon copy of an equivalent English legislation. In the post-1994 period, South Africa undertook our own comprehensive review of company law. And I would like to ask Tsulu Mushi now just to flight the presentation where the story carries on about the review process. And if we can go to slide number 3. I recall here that in 2004, South Africa undertook what I called a comprehensive review of company law. And in 2011, the Companies Act came into effect. It repealed the Companies Act of 1973. The new act introduced significant changes by providing inter alia for business rescue, for simplification of registration of a company, for a social and ethics committee for public companies. It added provisions for corporate governance, including financial accountability, and provisions relating to shareholder activism. The Act provided for a number of institutions, such as the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission, that's the CIPC, the Companies Tribunal, the Specialist Committee on Company Law, the Financial Reporting Standards Council, and the Takeover Regulation Panel. In the next slide, we go a bit into the later review. The Act itself was subject to review after 5 years of implementation. The DTIC took aspects of the Companies Act into account, reviewed it in order to identify the changes needed to keep up with current trends, but also to remedy some anomalies and eliminate certain deficiencies in the Act, as was discovered during implementation. The Ministry was able to draw on the expertise of a Specialist Committee on Company Law, which was established in 2011 in terms of Section 191 of the Act, to advise the Ministry on matters relating to company law policy. The committee has met regularly since its original appointment and have proposed various amendments. The committee is chaired by Michael Katz, and I want to acknowledge that the committee and Michael has done considerable work that has helped to clarify the various challenges and deficiencies in the Act, and that has contributed to the amendments that we're proposing. The original bill was published in the Government Gazette for public comment on the 21st of September in 2018, followed by extensive public engagement between government and a number of interested persons and organizations. Honorable members will see on the right-hand side on the screen in the green block, we indicate the kind of entities that made submissions. They range from the Specialist Committee on Company Law to the Institute of Chartered Accountants, the Banking Association, the Professional Accountants Institute, the Property Owners Association, Strait, the JSE, the Institute of Directors, the BEE Commission, the CIPC itself, investment and other players, and also own Zoom. On the next slide, we note that the draft bill was then sent to NEDLAC. And in the NEDLAC process, they are the NEDLAC parties, as was mentioned by the chair, the sad passing away of Prof. Ari Seftel, whose daughter is the executive director of NEDLAC. NEDLAC in the Trade, Industry and Competition Chamber has representatives from both business and labor. And the bill was sent to NEDLAC for comment. COVID interrupted that process. But there was also very detailed discussion, and NEDLAC took a two-year period and had 11 meetings. They also made quite substantial changes that they recommended to us in the bill. Following the conclusion of engagement at NEDLAC, the draft bill was published for comment a second time in October 2021. Subsequently, the DTIC received 78 submissions from stakeholders, and these were then reviewed and considered, and we revised the bill quite substantially into largely speaking its current form. There were also more than 900 email submissions simply indicating that they support or they don't support. Submissions that were received in 2021 included, there were 78 in all. We haven't listed all of those here, but just to give members of the committee a flavor. Fluxman's, Quantum Foods, Amabungani, AfriForum, Cliff Decker, Offmeyer, Sasol, Corruption Watch, Old Mutual, the Minerals Council, Alan Gray, it included also the Banking Association, National Treasury, MultiChoice, COSATU, FEDUSA, the National Union of Mine Workers, the NEHAU, SAKAU, as well as the Black Management Forum, the Finance Trade Union, Private Equity Association, and others. On the next slide, within having now received very, very detailed comments from NEDLAC, revising the bill, publishing it for public comment, taking that public comment into account, we then went to Cabinet, and following approval by Cabinet, the bill was introduced in Parliament on the 28th of August this year and presented to the Portfolio Committee on the 29th of August. The Department obtained two legal opinions on the tagging from Senior Counsel, which advised the bill should be classified under Section 75 of the Constitution. The bills were published on Parliament's website, social media, and newspapers from 5 September to 2 October. The Portfolio Committee of the National Assembly received 41 substantive submissions, and public hearings were held in mid-October. The department responded to the public submissions on the 24th of October. Deliberations were concluded thereafter with adoption of the reports by the portfolio committee, and formal consideration of the bills was on 22 November. The National Assembly adopted the bills on the 30th of November. On the next slide, we look at the core policy objectives of the bill. The regional published bill addressed three key policy objectives. The first one was to promote the ease of doing business. The second was the achievement of greater equity between directors and management on the one hand, and shareholders and workers on the other hand, and to address public concerns regarding high levels of income inequality in society. And finally, it dealt with efforts to counter money laundering and terrorism and promote transparency about share ownership. I'd like to briefly expand on these. On the next slide, we start with the ease of doing business. Honorable members will agree that company law should always be clear, should be user-friendly, should be consistent with well-established principles, and it should not be overburdensome on business. By its nature, it does set a regulatory frame. And without a regulatory frame, we'll have the law of the jungle. There would be no clarity and certainty on these key institutions that society rely on, namely corporations. But at the same time, we must find that balance. It's important to attract investors and for the efficient and effective conduct of the domestic economy and job creation. Many of the amendments are technical and based on submissions from stakeholders, and they're designed to ease the doing of business through providing legal certainty where these do not currently apply, by providing greater flexibility to companies in certain circumstances, and by removing unnecessary provisions in the Act. Many of the amendments set out in the bill address these areas. If I could ask that we move to the next slide, I want to go then to the second objective of the bill. And that deals with how to get a better balance, or to use the more appropriate term, better equity between directors and senior management on the one hand and shareholders and workers on the other hand, and address public concerns regarding high levels of inequalities in society. Some of the proposed amendments are designed to achieve better disclosure of senior executive remuneration, and that will allow society to look at the reasonableness of the remuneration. These issues are addressed mainly in the proposed requirement for a remuneration report. These are issues that have raised similar concerns in other countries across the world. So we're not the first country having to deal with a particularly striking feature of globalization, and that is the rising inequalities within societies and between societies. The provisions relating to transparency on the pay gap and the reasonableness of remuneration provide an objective benchmark which will assist the public dialogue on this topic. The bill proposes that the remuneration report be presented annually to shareholders, containing, among others, improved disclosure requirements for senior company officials, as well as the remuneration ratios between the top earners of a company and the bottom earners. So we look in the bill, it requires, for example, that the top 5% of income be disclosed and the bottom 5%, so that society can look at shareholders and workers and others can look at whether a company's ratio is out of line with its peers and with society's expectations. The third area is measures to counter money laundering and promote share ownership transparency. Honorable members will recall that South Africa's rating in the mutual evaluation assessment of the country's anti-money laundering and combating the financing of terrorism pointed to weaknesses in determining the true owner of shares in companies. This is what led to what was called grey listing. To address this, the original bill, not the one before the committee now, not the one that went to the portfolio committee, but the original bill that we published in 2021, that bill proposed amendments relating to disclosure of ultimate beneficial ownership in the shares of a company. However, in 2022, a General Laws Amendment Act was approved by Parliament to amend inter alia the Companies Act, and it addressed many of the provisions of the original Companies Amendment Bill dealing with money laundering. And there it was principally about who is the true shareholder in a company. Can you hide your identity through a trust or another company that you own, who in turn owns shares in a company? Or should there be an obligation on the shareholder and on the company to ensure that it knows who truly owns the shares of the company? On 24 May this year, I published regulations to bring into effect the new provisions in the Act relating to beneficial interest in shares. Regulation 39 and 10 provide access to the public to the annual returns filed with the Commission. And the current bill focuses on the remaining gaps relating to transparency through facilitating additional public access to specified information. On the next slide, we just summarize the overview of developments since 2021. There were three big developments that I draw attention to. The first, as I indicated earlier, is the General Laws Amendment Act of 2022 that was published, and we could then amend the original bill to reflect those changes relating to beneficial ownership. The original bill was amended by the Companies Amendment Bill, taking account of public representation, so it's a second set of developments. And a new bill was developed, namely a company's second amendment bill. This bill arises from a very separate process, namely the findings of the Judicial Commission into State Capture, what we popularly call the Zondo Commission. And the background to this bill, as well as the details of the proposed changes, will be covered in the last part of this presentation. So to recall, if we go back to slide 11, first we amended the 2021 bill that was there for public consultation to take account of various developments. And secondly, we developed an additional bill. That's why the committee has before you today two bills. Let's proceed then to slide. This one is now dealing with a Companies Amendment Bill, and I'm going to very briefly go through each section in the documentation that Parliament has. It provides a more detailed explanation of some of these provisions, but what we do in the next number of slides is identify a problem in the current bill, either a formulation that's inadequate or a gap in the bill. We look at the solution that the bill proposes, and then we point to the effect of that. to section one is a relatively straightforward one. It's on the definitions in the bill, and we point, for example, to the definition of securities, and the solution was to tighten up some of the definitions, and the effect is to ensure an alignment between terms used in the text of the Act and the definition section. The uncertainty in the definition of securities will have been remedied and is intended to improve the ease of doing business. Section 2, or rather Clause 2, is the amendment of Section 16. The problem is that uncertainty exists as to the effective date of amendments to a company's memorandum of incorporation. The solution is the solution that's proposed is that Section 16 be amended by providing that the notice of amendment of this memorandum of incorporation, it's sometimes called an MOI, will take place 10 business days after receipt of the notice by the CIPC. If the Commission, after expiry of the 10 business days, has not endorsed the notice or has failed to deliver a rejection of the notice with reasons, then the notice is effectively deemed to be implemented. Now, the effect of it is that there will be certainty on the effective date of an amendment to a company's MOI. And this is important because if there's litigation, for example, you need to look at not the date that a company took a resolution, but the date when the MOI amendment came into effect. So this creates more certainty in the market, and it makes it easier for parties to do business because everybody understands on which given day a date an MOI amendment is effective. On the next slide, Clause 3, this seeks to amend Section 25. The problem, a notice which a company is required to file in terms of Section 25.2 should be published by the Commission, but there's no requirement at present. The section we propose be amended to require the notice filed by the company to be published by the Commission. And again, the effect of this is to provide clarity in respect of publication. Clause 4 deals with Section 26. Start with the problem. The document to which access must be given does not include the new register of disclosure of beneficial interest to the, of the company. This, of course, limits transparency on true ownership of the shares in a company. We don't want to frame the law too widely, and we wanted it to be limited to larger publicly listed companies and larger general companies. I'll later on explain some of the tests that are set out in the existing Act on the size of companies that are covered by certain of the amendments. The solution was that provision should be made for the register of the disclosure of beneficial interest to be included in documents to which there's a right of access. The right of inspection of documents should not apply to private companies, to personal liability companies, and to non-profit companies whose public interest score fall below the prescribed threshold. The effect of the amendment is to promote greater transparency and access to information. The register of disclosure of beneficial interest in a company falls within the documents in respect of which there's a right to access in terms of Section 26. The legislation will exclude certain types of companies and not make the law burdensome. On the next slide, we have a technical note on public interest score. The Companies Act and its regulations provide for certain requirements in the Act to apply only to a particular type of companies where there's a public expectation that the company would be covered. Let's call them, just for shorthand, larger companies. This means a number of provisions would not apply to smaller or medium-sized firms. Now, how do you identify a larger company? To identify such companies, the law provides something called a public interest score. Regulation 26.2 sets out that a public interest score is calculated by giving points equal to the number of employees of the company. So if you've got 10,000 employees, you get that number of points. Then you get points for each million rand in third-party liability of the company. So that will indicate some of the risks associated with the company in society. Then you give 1 point for every million rand in annual turnover of a company, and that points to size. And you give 1 point for each individual known to have a beneficial interest in a company, or a member of a company, or a member of an association that's a member of a company. So in other words, how broad-based is its shareholding or membership? Then companies with a score above the threshold set out in the regulations will have certain of the obligations set out in the bill being applicable to them. And we point out at the bottom of the slide which sections of the bill would be affected by the public interest score. Now, we recognize that with certain of these measures, like turnover of a company, a turnover that was set in 2011 would be very different in real terms today because of the erosive effect of inflation. And so the public interest score will be updated through regulation. The next slide goes back to the clauses, and here we look at clause 5, which is the amendment to section 30. There is no obligation to name the director or prescribed officer who receives remuneration and benefits. This limits the necessary transparency that's required about the remuneration of the top officials of a company. To address this, the disclosure in the financial statement of remuneration and benefits received by a director or a prescribed officer should be part of the disclosure requirement, and those officers need to be named. The effect of the proposal is to promote transparency in the remuneration of top officials. And this would be, there's a legitimate public interest in knowing that information. The next slide goes to clause 6. And these were quite significant amendments. As set out in the second policy pillar that I spoke to earlier and that's contained in this presentation, the current Act is deficient in dealing with the proper relationship and balance between directors and senior management on the one hand and shareholders and workers on the other hand. There's inadequate provision for the disclosure of senior executive remuneration and the reasonableness of the remuneration. There's also a lack of transparency on the pay gap and the reasonableness of the remuneration to provide an objective benchmark which will assist the public dialogue on this topic. In the solution, the introduction of a new section in the Act to address this has been drafted, The nature and content of the requirements are extensive. Provision is made for procedures to regulate the required shareholder approval of remuneration policies. In addition, provision is made for the consequences of a failure to obtain the required approval. And this provision was substantially revised during the Portfolio Committee proceedings to provide for what is colloquially known as a two-strike rule applicable to non-executive directors who are members of the Remuneration Committee. The effect of this is that there will now be a statutory requirement for public companies and state-owned companies to produce the remuneration policy for approval by an ordinary resolution of an AGM. And provision is made for the consequence of failure to obtain the required approvals. We then on the next two slides deal with an information note on remuneration. There's been significant public interest in matters of remuneration policies and practices in companies. The bill in Section 30 provides that where remuneration and benefits are received by company directors or prescribed officers, such directors or prescribed officers must be named in the annual financial statements. This is limited to companies that are required in terms of their act to have their annual financial statements audited. In other words, they are above the threshold applicable in terms of public interest scores. The bill further proposes the insertion of a new Section 30A and Section 30B, obliging public companies and state-owned companies to prepare and present the director's remuneration report for approval by the shareholders of the company. This section prescribes the format and content of the report, its presentation to shareholders at an AGM, and the consequences following the failure of the report to obtain the required shareholder approval. We continue on the next slide by saying the remuneration policy should be presented at an AGM for approval by ordinary resolution. Once it's approved, the policy would only have to be presented every 3 years or whenever there's a material change. Should a remuneration policy not be approved, it must be presented at the next AGM until approval is obtained. Changes to the policy may only be implemented once shareholders approve it. Companies will now also be required to publish details of their highest paid employees, their lowest paid employee, the average remuneration, the median remuneration, and the gap between the top 5% highest paid and the bottom 5% lowest paid employees. The proposal for greater transparency and for publication of the pay gap are in line with a number of private and other initiatives across the world. It's noted that the King Report on Corporate Governance states that, and I quote, the remuneration of executive management should be fair and responsible in the context of overall employee remuneration. It should be disclosed how this has been addressed. This acknowledges the need to address the gap between the remuneration of executives and those at the lower end of the pay scale. I'd like to then go now to the next clause, which is Clause 7, is the amendment of Section 33. Here we make that point that every company must currently file an annual return with a CIPC accompanied by a copy of its latest financial statement. We have been advised that this requirement is burdensome for small companies. So the solution is that the requirement to file a copy of annual financial statements approved by the board with the annual return should only apply to public companies, state-owned companies, or other profit or non-profit companies whose public interest score exceeds the limit set out in Section 30 to all the regulations that have been put in place. This will obviously reduce the burden on small companies. The Companies Act will be less onerous as a result of this for small companies and cut red tape, as the obligation to file with the annual return a copy of the annual financial statements would not apply to companies whose public interest score is lower than the limit set out in Section 32 as read with the regulations. I go next to the next clause, clause 8. It deals with 30A. There's no provision in the Act which empowers a court to validate the creation, the allotment, or the issue of shares which would otherwise be invalid, even where there's good reasons for doing so. For example, if shares were issued, but certain technical requirements were not followed, a company is required currently to cancel the shares. This can be very disruptive in the market, with little to gain for corporate governance and looking after the interests of shareholders and society. The solution is to empower a court to validate the creation, allotment, or issue of shares that would otherwise be invalid on application to the court by a company or any person who holds an interest in the company. Obviously, courts will look for good reason. The effect of the amendment is that where there is a good reason for courts to validate an otherwise invalid action, the courts will be empowered to do so. The court can issue conditions, and all of this will improve the ease of doing business. The next slide deals with clause 9, and that's section 40 of the Act, which prohibits the issuing of partly paid shares as a protection for stakeholders in the company. The reference in section 40 to a trust and trust agreement are erroneous, as they could introduce principles of trust law and could give rise to the wrong application or principles that are not applicable to the context of Section 40. The solution is to replace references to a third party with references to a stakeholder, and the references to a trust to be replaced with references to a stakeholder agreement. The effect is that the arrangements will be governed by principles of stakeholder arrangements and not principles of trust law. These are, I am told by those who keep a careful eye on it, very different principles. This is a more flexible arrangement than what would apply under trust law, and this would then simplify the conduct of business. The next slide deals with clause 10, section 45, currently prohibits the giving of financial assistance by a company to its holding company, its fellow subsidiaries, and its own subsidiaries. This financial assistance to its own subsidiaries, in the view of the Specialist Committee on Company Law, is erroneous and is creating unnecessary compliance burdens. The protections provided by this prohibition are not applicable to the giving of financial assistance by a company to its own subsidiary. The amendments propose the deletion of the prohibition against the giving of financial assistance by a company to its own subsidiary. The effect of this is spelled out at the bottom of the slide. Companies will not be prohibited from giving financial assistance to their own subsidiaries. The effect is that it will ease the doing of business by eliminating an unnecessary provision that did not provide any protection, but in practice caused serious compliance burdens. The next slide deals with clause 11, section 48. And section 48, 8 be referred to sections 114 and 115. It makes the act of a share buyback subject to the complexities that only apply to what is called a fundamental transaction, which are the disposal by a company of its major asset, the entering into of a statutory merger or a scheme of arrangement. Now, the way the law is currently worded gives rise to difficult issues of interpretation and compliance, and they're not consistent with the pattern of the protection to companies and shareholders in the Act. The solution is to require a special resolution of shareholders for the purpose of approving share buybacks by companies, other than where a company does a pro rata buyback from all of its shareholders, or does a buyback on a recognized exchange. Remaining provisions of Section 48 will remain intact. Section 115 will continue to apply to fundamental transactions, which of course, as I've indicated, is the disposal by a company of its major assets, the entering into a statutory merger or scheme of arrangement. Now, looking at the effect, we advise that the amendment will be in line with corresponding provisions in developed countries. The effect of the proposed amendment is to remove unnecessary provisions, align South African law with other jurisdictions, and make the conduct of business itself easier. And that is leads us to Clause 12, which covers Section 61 of the Act. There's no provision in subsection 61(8) of the Act requiring the presentation at an AGM of a Social and Ethics Committee report and a remuneration report. There's also no provision for the Social and Ethics Committee to be appointed at an AGM. The proposal is that the Companies Act be, that firms themselves, companies, be required at AGMs to present a Social and Ethics Committee report and a remuneration report, and that companies should be required to appoint a Social and Ethics Committee at the AGM. This is important because these committees play a very particular role in ensuring that companies don't only look at the financial bottom line, but they also take account of their social responsibilities, and that companies also have proper and appropriate regard to conducting business in an ethical manner. The effect of the amendment is that the Social and Ethics Committees, which is an idea that was introduced in the 2008 Act, will now be given more weight and responsibility with a degree of independence from the board, unlike other normal board committees. This will assist in ensuring that companies give due weight to social and ethical matters in the conduct of their business. We go next to Section 72, which is set out in Clause 13. Since the original enactment of the Act, extensive developments in conventional wisdom has occurred in relation to environment issues, the role of a company in society, and matters of governance. In fact, even the purpose of a company has now come under sharper focus. We believe that, and this is a good thing for South African law, that the foundation for those issues was already laid in Section 72 of the Act. However, the developments since then indicate there are gaps which need to be filled, and there are certain administrative and procedural deficiencies that need to be fixed. The amendments to Section 72 seek to remedy the gaps and procedural deficiencies. The effect of it is that the administrative and procedural changes will make the workings of the Social and Ethics Committees more efficient and fit for purpose. And we've got an information note on Social and Ethics Committees on slide 29. So just to recall that the Companies Act in 2008 took a significant step in the shift from a shareholder model of companies to a stakeholder model, providing, among others,
for specified roles for trade unions and the establishment of social and ethics committees in companies. The bill now takes this forward by setting out a number of the modalities and practical arrangements for such committees. This include, among others, the composition of the Social and Ethics Committee, the filling of vacancies, the timing of the appointment, and provisions for exemption. It also provides for the presentation and approval of the Social and Ethics Committee report at the AGM. I next move to Clause 14, which is the amendment of Sections 90. There's no provision currently as to when appointment of an auditor must take place. The cooling off period of 5 years must lapse before an auditor can be appointed to a company if it's had past involvement with a company, has been deemed by many companies to be too long. And they say the period is too long in relation to the number of top audit firms that are available to firms in the South African market. The proposed solution is that the appointment of an auditor should take place annually at the shareholders meeting, and that the cooling off period of 5 years should be reduced to 2 years. The effect of the amendment is to have greater clarity that the appointment of auditors must take place annually at shareholders meetings, and the reduction in the cooling off period is intended to enable companies to use the limited pool of audit firms with required international and other technical expertise more effectively. Clause 15 deals with the amendment to Section 95, and this the problem statement says that the purchase of shares is not competent in the case of an employee share ownership scheme, these are the ESOPs, which at presently requires either an issue of share or the grant of option of shares. So ESOPs, this is where workers own shares, they can't buy shares into this scheme. This is unduly restrictive, and the solution is to permit the issue of shares, or the purchase of shares in the company. The requirements of an employee share scheme would now permit acquisition by means of the issue or purchase of shares in the company, and it's done to support further growth and utilization of employee share ownership schemes. So this is about broadening the base, but also simplifying and making the law more fit for purpose. We go next to Clause 16, which is the amendment of Section 118. The Takeover Regulation Panel, currently in the Act, has jurisdiction over a range of entities, and the requirements of those categories are not achieving any benefit of protecting shareholders in a number of cases, and they've been proved to be unnecessarily burdensome in practice. It's proposed that the categories of private companies over which the Takeover Regulation Panel has jurisdiction should be limited to private companies that have 10 or more shareholders with direct or indirect shareholding in the company. And the company must exceed the financial threshold of annual turnover or asset values determined by the minister in consultation with the TRP. Businesses and for businesses with a limited number of shareholders, and reduces the administrative load on the TRP. Clause 17 deals with the amendment of Section 135. When a company is in business rescue, and the landlord has paid the company's share of rates, or taxes, or electricity, or water bills, during the business rescue proceedings, such a landlord cannot recover the monies from the tenant in business rescue because of the statutory moratorium, and the landlord is placed in a disadvantageous financial position, potentially resulting in the cutting off of basic services. The solution proposed is that the landlord of a tenant in business rescue who pays the liabilities to public entities should be regarded as a provider of post-commencement financing with the appropriate ranking of preferences arising from it. The effect of the amendment is to enable landlords to continue to ensure that rates and taxes, electricity and water, sanitation and sewer charges are paid, that the services are retained, and that the landlord is reimbursed through the appropriate ranking of preferences arising from its status as post-commencement financing. We turn next to clause 18, dealing with section 160. There's no date when the company's tribunal issues an administrative order for the company to comply with before an applicant can approach the commission to change its name. The proposal is that the company's tribunal must stipulate the date of the administrative order for the company to comply with before the applicant can approach the commission to change its name. And this provides legal clarity, which improves the ease of doing business. Clause 19 is the amendment of Section 166. There's no provision for a dispute to be referred to arbitration if the mediation or conciliation process of the Act has failed. So the solution is to provide that if the tribunal has issued a certificate stating that mediation or conciliation has failed, the matter may be referred to arbitration. The amendment provides legal clarity and enables the tribunal to have a seamless process that includes conciliation and arbitration. This is very much in line with what we see in modern systems of dispute resolution. Clause 20 is the amendment of Section 167. There's obsolete provisions in Section 167, and the proposal is to delete these. I go into Section 194, which is Clause 21. The legislation does not permit the chairperson of the company's tribunal to appoint a COO, and there's insufficient provision for certain administrative and operational authority relating to the tribunal. The granting of authority to the chairperson of the tribunal to appoint a COO is now covered, and this will be an enhancement of the administrative and operational issues relating to the company's tribunal. This cuts both ambiguity and red tape. Clause 22 is an amendment to Section 195. The problem we're trying to deal with is there's an omission to grant authority to the tribunal to conciliate, mediate, or arbitrate on administrative matters affecting any person in terms of the Act that may be referred to the tribunal by the BEE Commission. So we're fixing this by putting in a provision that gives the company's tribunal this power, and the effect of it is to enable the commission, the BEE Commission, to refer complaints of companies not following the governance procedures in the Companies Act to the detriment of BEE shareholders. Examples of these may include when a company don't keep proper company records to prevent BEE shareholders from understanding company affairs, or by excluding minority BEE shareholders from company affairs, including shareholder decisions, or by falsifying company records, or by diverting economic benefits of a company to the non-BEE shareholders through contractual or other arrangements. We go then to Clause 23, which is the amendment to Section 204, and this is the last of the amendments that we want to refer to in the first bill. The problem we're dealing with is the omission of empowering the Financial Reporting Standards Council to issue reporting pronouncements on international benchmarking standards where these need to be adapted for local purposes. The proposal is to give the FRSC that power, and the effect is to customize reporting standards to the needs of the South African economy and our own regulatory requirements, for example, on tax regulations or BEE transactions. I now go to the last part of the substantive comments, and that is on the company's second amendment bill. The Zondo Commission of Inquiry, Interstate Capture, made a recommendation to amend the Companies Act to extend the time bar, which is contained in Section 162.2 and 162.3 of the Companies Act. Section 162 of the Companies Act makes provision for an application to a court for an order declaring a person delinquent or under probation. So we provide a bit of details on this in a technical note. So start with, what is a delinquent director? Section 162 of the Companies Act deals with the topic of delinquency and states that a court must declare a director to be delinquent where they have failed to discharge their duties in terms of the Companies Act, provided they either currently a director or they were a director in the 24 months preceding the application. What are the grounds on to be declared a delinquent director? Section 162.5 of the Act contains a number of grounds on which a person may be declared a delinquent director. These include a director who grossly abused their position or took personal advantage of information of an opportunity to gain an advantage for another person other than the company on whose board the director serves, or knowingly causes harm to the company or subsidiary of the company, or who, excuse me, intentionally or by gross negligence, inflict harm upon the company or subsidiary of the company, or act in a manner that amounts to gross negligence, willful misconduct, or breach of trust in relation to the performance of the director's functions within the company or the duties to the company. We next look on the next slide at the implications of being declared a delinquent director. The implications of being declared a delinquent director are serious. Such a declaration in terms of Section 162.6 is unconditional and subsists for the lifetime of the director concerned. Section 5(c)(f) may be made subject to any conditions that the court considers appropriate, including a limitation of the declaration to one or more categories of companies, and it lasts for 7 years from the date of the order or such longer period as determined by the court at the time of making the declaration. So depending under which section of the Act the court declares delinquency, it could have different, but in both cases, very, very substantial consequences. The court may change this order after 3 years and place the director under probation in terms of Section 162.11a. Directors declared delinquent are listed as such on the CIPC record, which allows registered customers to search an individual's directorship history prior to being considered for appointment to the board of a company. In addition, the court may grant appropriate relief to the companies involved, who may consequently claim damages from a director for losses incurred as a result of their conduct. So we go back to the core policy objectives of the bill. An application of delinquency may be brought if the person concerned is a director of that company or within 24 months immediately preceding the application was a director of that company. That's the law as it stands at the moment. The Zondo Commission has made a recommendation in respect of two specific companies and certain persons connected with those companies that Section 162 of the Companies Act be amended so as to ensure that the application for a declaration of delinquency may be brought even after the 2 years on good cause shown. While these recommendations of the Zondo Commission were limited to specific cases, it was considered to be in the public interest that any amendments to the Companies Act to extend the time bar in the Act should be of wider application and should apply generally. In the next slide, we note that research was undertaken that indicates a number of countries or legal jurisdictions have different time bars for applications for declaration of delinquency. The corresponding provisions in New York, in New Zealand's Companies Act have the longest time bar, namely 5 years. The time bar in applications for declaration of delinquency must be balanced and fair to both the applicant and the defendant, having regard to the implication of lapse of time, reduced memories, and inability to find relevant records. So the bill proposes that the period of 5 years is appropriate. However, in certain circumstances, even the time bar of 5 years may be insufficient and the court should be empowered on good cause shown to extend that time period in a specific case. Furthermore, when good cause is shown to the court to extend the time bar, such power of the court should include the right to extend the time period even in respect of the circumstances that are set out in Section 162 of the Companies Act, which may have occurred in the period before the extension. In exercising its powers in this regard, the court will take into account the interests of justice and fairness. Turning to the next slide, the proposed legislation should be expressed to be retrospective, thus the legislation should state that the court on good cause shown may extend the time bar even though the conduct in question was committed during the period before the extension. Now here, critically, we leave that discretion to the courts. It's not a matter that the statute regulates. The statute enables the court on good cause shown to ensure that the time period can be extended. Although it wasn't the subject of a recommendation from the Zondo Commission, on reflection, the time bar in Section 77(7) of the Companies Act also requires amendment. Section 77 deals with the liability of directors and prescribed officers for breaching their fiduciary duties and their duties of care, skill and diligence, as well as certain statutory duties. It provides that proceedings to recover any loss, damages or costs for which a person is liable or can be held liable in terms of the section of the Act may not be commenced more than 3 years after the Act or Commission that gave rise to that liability. While the period of 3 years conform with international best practice, it was considered necessary and appropriate that the court should also be empowered on good cause shown to extend the time bar of 3 years on the basis that such extended period may also cover acts or omissions that occurred during the period before the extension. The next few slides just go into the details. Two more slides. Slide 47 deals with Section 77(7). It contains a time bar of 3 years within which an action against a director to recover loss, damages, or costs for a breach of fiduciary duties or duties of care, skill, and diligence must be brought. Now, this period, as we indicated, in circumstances may be too short. The solution is to empower the court on good cause shown to extend this period, including having retrospective effect. The effect of this is that the amendment can provide for actions to be taken against directors even after they are no longer directors, nor have they been directors for the three-year period preceding the action. By giving the power to a court to make the decision, it provides for the interest of justice to be paramount and not to be unnecessarily restricted by the current time bar. The merits of its application in any given circumstance will be determined by a competent court, and we make the point that it does allow society to claim back from those who served on company boards and acted particularly for state-owned companies during the state capture period to deprive the state and the South African public of its assets and resources through acting without care, skill and diligence. The next slide deals with the amendment to section 162(2) and 3, and this is the action to declare a director delinquent. As I've noted, currently it's time barred to 24 months, you can't bring any action after this 24 months, and this period may be too short in cases of delinquency committed, for example, during state capture. The solution is that the period of 24 months be extended to 60 months, and the court be given power on good cause shown to extend the period further and with retrospective effect. The effect will be to bring actions to declare directors delinquent up to 60 months after ceasing to be a director, and even longer if a court so orders on good cause shown, including with retrospective effect. By giving the power to a court to make the decision, it provides for the interest of justice to be paramount and not unnecessarily restricted. The merits of an application in any given instance will be determined by a competent court. Chairperson, I've taken quite a bit of time to go through each of these amendments and provided also some general information and a few technical notes that we hope can assist the committee in undertaking its review of the two bills. May I thank you for this opportunity and hand the floor back to the chairperson.
Thank you so much, Honorable Minister, for the presentation. It's very informative. What I like about it, it deals with the problem and the solution, and also the effect of the solution. It's going to make it easier, especially when we get the submission from the public, and they link what they are sending to each of those section or clauses. It's going to make it very easy. Before I give opportunity to members, I'd like to first give opportunity to the Constitutional and Legal Services Office if they would like to make any comments. Ms. Ibrahim?
Good morning. Thank you.
Guys, I was in and out. I was in Parliament, so I have...
Honorable Jambo?
Thank you. Hello?
Now, we are giving opportunity to Ms. Ibrahim for her comments on the two bills.
Thank you.
We'll thereafter then give opportunity to members to ask questions of clarities. Is that okay? Over to you, Ms. Ibrahim.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, we're satisfied with the explanation, the very thorough explanation given by the Minister. The Portfolio Committee was involved in quite an in-depth
process in looking at these bills, you would see that from the introduced version compared to the B bill that's in front of the Select Committee now, there are quite a few changes. Those changes would have come from the public submissions and our regard to what the public has to say. Also, efforts from our office to ensure that the bill read a little bit more clearly. So from our side, we are very happy with the content of the bill as it stands. But of course, we wait to see what further public submissions will have to say on the bill as it has been revised. Thank you, Chair.
Sorry, do you know if the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor is on the platform?
Let me check quickly, Chairperson.
Okay.
No, Chair, I do not see them online.
Were they part of the portfolio committee processes?
Yes, Chair, they were part of the process in part. The A-list was drafted by ourselves together with the department. There was a letter, as I understand it, from the chairperson of the portfolio committee inviting them to make any further comments if they so wish. The portfolio committee also had concerns on the constitutionality of one or two aspects of the bill. Our office gave a oral legal opinion on that, and the department also followed up with a written legal opinion from senior counsel. So there was satisfaction at the end of the process that the bill was constitutionally sound.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. Honourable members, I will now give opportunity to honourable members to ask questions. First hand is that of Honourable Lont, followed by Honourable Dango. In that order. Honourable Lont, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Morning, Honourable High members. Before I get into some of the substance, I just want clarity, Honourable Khai. And I remember we had a similar situation a while back where I raised matters that came from the NA, and you pointed out that we need to make sure that we get a proper briefing and also treat it the same way as the colleagues on that side. So the legal opinion that was provided to the Portfolio Committee, I think it's important that we also get that and the parts that were responded to and addressed, and also the parts that were not addressed. We can't be assumed that we know that what went on the NA side. And then, Chairperson, just if I've missed that somewhere, I would appreciate just some clarity, the timelines that you foresee how this plays out, because you know we'll be rising next week, I think, and it is going to be quite a hectic schedule next year as well until May. So I just want to get some clarity on the timeline, how you have got it at this stage. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Honourable Dango?
Chairperson, I'm covered, but I was kicked in and out by the system like you were in Parliament. I came to Parliament as well. So I didn't get all of the gist of what the Minister was explaining, but I'll follow up. Thank you.
All right, thank you so much. Honourable Mwema.
Thank you, Chair. Greetings to yourself and the Minister. I'm in a bit of an awkward situation, so if the Chair allows me just to put my patience across without necessarily issue on the video. The two issues that I want to converse with the Minister. The first one relates to the provision of the social and ethics imperatives in the first bill, whether would it not be important to also like the requirement of the filing of the financial statement with the annual returns. I thought it could also be correct to ensure that the social and ethics committee reports and not only be restricted to the annual general meeting or the shareholders meeting, but also when the annual returns are filed with the of the office of the CIPC, then the same in terms of the social and ethics committee reports is filed also. The second one relates to the issue of the gender pay gap. The gender pay gap, which is also an imperative for transformation, taking into account our commitment to close the gap between the highest and the lowest paid, which is quite pronounced in the provision of the bill. But this one looks like the issue of the gender pay gap is related to the Pay Equity Act, but taking into account the impetus for transformation from social from the religious party, I think it's an area that one would be interested to get a sense of to the views of the department in relation to providing that in the amendment bill, because it is quite important. Other than that, I think the other areas are quite explicit, particularly in relation to the remuneration policy, and filing thereof also with the agile practices statement. That's that area. In relation to the Second Amendment bill, that would be the Zondo Commission report. I think it's quite more pronounced. I think the only area, definitely, the last one is whether the bill sufficiently covers the areas of concern which led to our grade listing. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, Honorable Mima. Are there any other hands? Not. Honorable Minister, just the clarity on the technical note on the public interest score. When I was also going through the presentation, when we received it, I got stuck also when I got to this area, especially B. It says 1 point for each 1 million rand in the third party liability of the company. I was listening as you were explaining, you did, but you were very short and you left me still not sure what is meant by that. Just before you respond, I just want to clarify to Honorable Lont that in terms of the process, the legislative process, will continue to have Ms. Fatima Ibrahim throughout the process, advising us from time to time, but also we have Samara Ali, the procedural officer. But Ms. Grace has Denise Zule sent me a WhatsApp message about the apology of Advocate Samara Ali. We received the same last week on Wednesday. It was related to her child, but with her child speedy recovery, we hope that she'll be able to join us during the course of the process of this lawmaking. We do have a draft program that we will be tabling after this engagement on this bill right now, which includes dates up until we adopted the report of these two bills. So we'll flag that after we have had all the responses from the minister. I hope that clarifies. We'll flight it. Members will make comments, and then we call for the adoption of the draft program. Thank you so much. Over to you, Honourable Minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And thank you to the Honourable Members for the comments and questions. If I can focus, I think with Honourable Lont, I understand that those questions were not directed specifically to me, but if there's anything I can do or the department can do to facilitate, we would be very open and very available to do so. On Honourable Moyimang's questions, let me start with the SEC report. That would be typically presented at an annual general meeting, and previously where there was some ambiguity about it, all of this is now clarified. In all the representations made to us to date, there's not been a proposal for the reports, the SEC report to be filed with the CIPC, so we've not given that any consideration as yet. We can give that a bit further reflection and see from the comments that we rely on from experts in this area whether this would be something that would be a viable proposition. I would certainly be happy to come back to both the committee and Honourable Moyimang on that proposal. On the gender pay gap, we were particularly supportive of the idea of a gender pay gap being addressed in our legislation. But yeah, at the moment, what we're seeking to do is to introduce the broader aspect of pay ratios. And so in the bill that was published for public comment in 2021, it did not refer specifically to gender pay ratios. And this did not come up through the NEDLAC process either. And given that the NEDLAC process had been such a lengthy process, it was important to try to conclude a bill that had gone carefully and thoroughly through the NEDLAC process. So the bill that was then introduced into Parliament had provision in general for a pay gap, an aggregate pay gap. In the course of public comment, two very interesting sets of comments were made. The first was that a deficiency potentially is that the bill does not provide for subcontracted employees, i.e. employees of a company that is legally distinct from the company that has the disclosure requirement, but whose employees in turn provide services to that company. And the challenge that was pointed out to us by a number of commentators is that this can encourage companies to subcontract. The second observation that was made, it was also a very important observation, is that given society's concerns about gender equity, we need to take into account the value of putting in a gender ratio in the reporting requirements. From a policy point, I see great value to putting a gender ratio disclosure in legislation. And it will address another pernicious form of discrimination in the labor market. However, I have recognized to the Portfolio Committee that the proposal had not been advertised for public comment by the department in 2021 or by the committee, nor has it benefited from consideration by either NEDLAC or the Specialist Committee on Company Law. And consideration will have to be given whether this would make the inclusion of such a proposal vulnerable either to poor drafting, because it's not had that opportunity to go through a detailed process. And in the case of the Portfolio Committee, I also indicated the danger of legal challenge. And given the time frames, it's a matter that Honorable Lond has pointed to, that if we were to include it in a bill that is for public comment, one of the considerations will be that such a bill would have to go back to the National Assembly. So that's a matter that I'm sure the committee may want to consider. I have approached the Specialist Committee on Company Law and asked that they prepare work for me on the opportunity to use the regulations that may then require that the report of the Social and Ethics Committee include a requirement to disclose gender pay ratios. That would then enable us at the time when the overall ratios are disclosed to also have the gender ratios disclosed. In addition to that, we do believe that what this process of consideration of the bill has identified is that there is further work for the next phase of amendments that would need to go through various processes. By their nature, as I pointed out, this process to amend this law took more than 6 years. In 2018, it was first published, and the work that went into the amendments preceded 2018. So these are very lengthy processes to amend company law because so many interest groups would normally be consulted in order to ensure that we take all points of view into account. So I think what the committee on the gender matter may want to give consideration to is whether it would want to consider a gender pay ratio. If it does so, it would have to put that in the public advert and in the bill. If it does so, that and it approves it, that bill would have to go back to the National Assembly. And if we run out of time, it would mean that the bill would lapse by the end of this term of Parliament and would have to be reconsidered in the next Parliament. So that's the trade-off. Alternatively, if the committee took the view that the bill in its current form constitutes a very significant progress in dealing with pay ratios, wage ratios, and inequality in society, that the gender provision, while important, would require careful consideration. There are some legal and other matters that have come up about how to capture it and what would be some of the matters that we'd have to give consideration to. The committee may decide that it wants to support that piece of work continues, that we take it to the Specialist Committee on Company Law, which is a statutory body. We take it to NEDLAC, and following the comments and advice that they've given, we come back to Parliament in future with a bill that can expand on this groundbreaking provisions that the current bill has. So that's really the two roads that we can adopt. They have different value and risks. As I have indicated in a discussion with the chairperson of the Specialist Committee on Company Law, we have looked carefully at the possibility of using regulations, current regulatory power, to expand the remit of the Social and Ethics Committee to also cover gender pay ratios. This matter was carefully considered by the Portfolio Committee, and the Portfolio Committee in the end decided that they would want to have the bill in its current form, i.e. dealing with the general wage ratio, to be put forward, and that they would encourage the department to do further work on the gender pay ratios. On balance, though I'm a strong supporter of ensuring that gender disparities are disclosed and thereafter addressed in society, at the same time, we have limited time to ensure that the bill is properly considered, that changes that are made have the benefit of discussion at NEDLAC and by the Specialist Committee. And in these circumstances, it seems to me prudent that the bill in its current form be considered. But this is, of course, ultimately a decision that the committee will need to make. We do have a time challenge in the current term of Parliament, and that would have to be carefully considered. Finally, on the public interest score, the question, Chairperson, is how does one define what we would colloquially call a larger company? How do we ensure that certain provisions that require a higher level of public disclosure or more detailed compliance requirements are not imposed on small companies? So we need to use a definition. There is a definition of small and medium enterprises, but for company law, that definition is inadequate. And so in 2008, when the Act was developed and passed by Parliament, Parliament put in a notion of a public interest score. And subsequently, the minister then had issued a regulation that spells out how the public interest score would work. And what the public interest score does, it sets out a series of criteria that you apply to a company, and you give points for each criterion, and you add that up to give a sense of whether a company, for purposes of the Act, would need to comply with certain provisions. So we've looked at turnover. Now, why don't we just use turnover on its own? Turnover is quite a significant category. This is the total value that the company generates from its economic activities. However, you could have a company that has a very large employment, but not as large a turnover. For example, these would be companies where they provide largely labor services to other players. And the very size of the company could justify it being required, the number of employees it has could require it to be covered by these, let's call it more advanced provisions. So turnover on its own won't be sufficient. Well, why not only take those two together and not look at any other criteria? Well, when the Specialist Committee and the Ministry at the time looked at it, it was very evident that in addition to that, the liability of a company publicly is important as a consideration. If a company is involved in activities where there is enormous risk to society, it would typically take out significant third-party liability, and that cover would then be another indication that it is a publicly significant company. And then some companies, if a company has one shareholder, or five shareholders, or 10 shareholders, it may be, from a public interest point of view, less significant than a company that has 1,000 shareholders. So this is not something that this bill introduces. This is in the Act and in the regulations as they currently stand. The reason we provided a little bit more detail here was to give the committee a background that some of the provisions that we are proposing in the bill would not apply to smaller companies, that they would only apply to what we call larger or more publicly significant companies. And that is because we want to ensure that in the design of regulation and legislation, that we don't unnecessarily burden smaller players. And this is consistent with some of those principles that I pointed to in the early part of the presentation today. Jefferson, I hope I have covered all of the issues that have been raised by members of the committee, but I stand to be reminded if there's any issue that I have not raised.
Thank you very much, Honorable Minister. Honorable members, any follow-up questions? I don't know, Honorable Moimang, if it's all hand.
No, it is not a legal theory. I think from the explanation given by Honorable Minister on the gender pay gap ratio, given the constraints of time as outlined, I think it's a matter definitely that in future that the department could look into it. But not in in the current time of processing this bill, so that it can also be it can also enjoy the benefit of being transparently at the level of NEDLAC, given the imperatives of gender transformation in our economy. So I think for now I'm happy with the explanation that the minister has just given on this issue. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you so much, Honorable Mima. If you can then lower your hand. Are there any other follow-up questions, Honorable members? Let's at this stage thank the Honorable Minister for the presentation on the two bills. I will now ask Mr. Bazia to flight the first term program of the committee, which also include the legislative process, how we will be then dealing with the two bills. We will, in terms of these particular bills, is from, I would say, this afternoon, start the process as the Constitution, Section 72, 1A in brackets, that of facilitating public involvement, which means that we will call for public comments on the two bills in the form of adverts, as we normally do. And then that period, I think, can you just go down where, Sis Grace, where does it start, the period of
the public hearings?
Yeah, the adverts.
Or we have not scheduled the adverts on the program. What I can say, we are in the process of getting the quotations from the supply chain management so that we can process the applications for political approval. And then we are hoping to run the advert from the 15th to the 17th of January 2024 for 2 weeks. But the closing date for the submissions will be the 2nd of February. And then we can start with the public hearings as from the 20th.
You say the advert will start from?
We are hoping to run the advert from the 15th to the 17th of January. And the closing date will be the 2nd of February.
Why that longer?
Because there are other in the first term program. There are other programs that are taking place, and then we will start with the public hearings on those dates, the 20th and the 27th. And then we do the responses on the 5th, and then the deliberations on the 12th of March, and the 19th of March we are finalizing. And then Tuesday, 26th March, we are considering and adopting we are finalizing the bill on the 19th of March.
I think Honourable members that this program is also informed by the Parliamentary Framework Program for 2024. On Thursday there was a joint programming committee of both houses where they developed the framework for next year. So the first week toward the end of the, if you can move up, Mr. Fazier, then towards the first week of towards the end of January, there's what they call that sixth parliament of voting and exit session. So there is a briefing for members so that those who will be exiting parliament that won't be coming back, they will be informed of the kind of benefits that they will be receiving, the tax implications, so those dates, the 30th to the 2nd of February, is about that. And then the week of the 5th of February, that will be on Monday, it's the week of the state of the nation address by the president, which will be on the 8th of February. So we decided that on that very week, we remember last week we had a meeting with the Department of Employment and Labor on issues related to compensation fund and the UIF, including the issue of the forensic report that the DG said it would be available to the public by the 31st of December. So we have then scheduled a meeting for the 6th to be briefed on that. Then on the 8th, then there will be the State of the Nation address, as I indicated. Then the following week, from the 13th, that whole week, it will be the debates on the State of the Nation address. That will take place at the City Hall. The 3 day meeting will start in the morning, so won't be able to schedule any committee meetings
on that week of the 13th. So the only then available days for committee meetings other than the 6th of February will be the 20th. So that's why then our very first meeting on the public hearing start on the 20th, because that's the only, that will be the start of the committee meetings. Other than that, there are no other dates for committee meetings because of the debate on the State of the Nation address. Usually they start in the afternoon, giving us time to have committee meetings in the morning. But in the joint programming committee meeting, it was decided that the debates on the State of the Nation address should be in the morning, starting at 10. So that will be the whole day on the 13th, 14th, and then on the 15th, it will be a reply by the Honorable President. So I'm just trying to emphasize why we only starting with the public hearings on the 20th of February. And then the whole of February, then the remaining days in February will be focusing on the two bills. And then on the 5th of March, department will then be responding to the submission made by the public. And on the 12th, we will then have a deliberation as members of the committee. We hope to finalize the bills on the 19th of March 2024. So with regard to the two bills, then that will be the legislative process that will be following. But we have combined the legislative process together with other programs of the committee, but there are only two. It will just be the meeting that will be on the 6th, and also the meeting that will be considering the adoption of the annual report, as well as the legacy report of the 6th Parliament. But in terms of the NCOP program, the program of the NCOP goes on until the 3rd of May in 2024. According to the that framework I referred to. So members of the NC will be recording until, because the challenge is that the date for the election has not yet been announced, but there's a view that it could be around May, so the NCOP will continue. Could be that the NA may end on the 31st of March, but the NCOP will continue beyond the 31st of March, according to that framework program. Yeah. I don't know if there are any comments, Honourable Members?
Chairperson, yes. Chairperson, I think we should just have a conversation with the department regarding the dates and come back for the finalization thereof, because I don't know how prepared they would be to go through all the processes.
No, let's leave it at that, Honorable Tango. We will share the program with the department through the normal channels. It is now a parliamentary process. It's no longer a departmental process. The department through the minister have done their part in terms of briefing the committee. So now the process is in the hands of the committee. We will liaise with the department as we normally do from time to time. We can't say the department must determine our program as a committee. So we're putting it up for comment and adoption by members. If I can have a hand to adopt the program, Honourable Members, if there are
sorry, no... My hand has been up now for a while.
Sorry. Okay.
I just want to ask something. I mean, you made a comment on the advertisement that it's a long period. My concern is that it's actually an incredibly short period, considering that, you know, South Africa, unlike many other countries, we pretty much closed down over December. And the effectiveness of the adverts over the December period is a concern. And since we're only starting the public hearings, I think it's on the 20th, it would maybe be wise to cover ourselves and make sure we have rather a longer period covering that and maybe less over the December period. But that's just a comment for you to consider. We've had this discussion in the past that placing adverts over December period is maybe not the best route to follow.
Okay, I think it's still longer because if we put it up on the 15th and it goes on until the 2nd, was it the 2nd of February for purposes of submissions, when does the deadline?
2nd of February.
Yeah. 2nd of February. So quite a long period, given that to the advert. The reason the advert is going to start on the 15th is because of the administrative and the logistic matters, because it must go to the relevant units within the department, supply chain management, all those processes. The language unit and all that. So that's why I think this case is of review that it will be ready then by the 15th, which will be next week, Friday. But then it will go on until the 2nd of February. And then we start with the actual public hearings then on the 28th. So it's quite a long period. I was just raising it, but I'm not saying that we should shorten the period. I agree with you that it has been raised in the past that December is not the best time for calling for comments. Yeah, so I agree with you on that score. So that's why then I say, okay, let's start then from the 15th until the 2nd of February. Any other comments? Can I then call for the mover and the seconder for the adoption of the program, honorable members?
I so move, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Any seconder?
I second, honorable Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Any counter for you? Not. So the program is adopted, honorable members. Thank you so much. At this stage, honorable minister, let me go back to you if we have any closing remarks. And after that, we will resist you so that we also deal with the internal matters, the adoption of the minutes, and the other announcements, if there are any.
Thank you very much, honorable minister. Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity just to make a short closing remark. I want to really appreciate this opportunity we've had today to take the committee through the bill. We're looking forward to working on any aspect where the committee may need any comment from the department. And as Chair, as you've said, it's now the process is now Parliament's process. So if there is anything, please feel free to contact us. Also, we will be ready at any stage that the committee is requires the department to respond. I do just want to flag for reflection and thought that because the date of the election is not yet known, that may, of course, depending on what date the election is finally decided, that may truncate the available time, and I'm sure the committee would no doubt want to review dates once it has given some thought to that and once it's reflected on that. But thank you very much, Chairperson, for this opportunity, and we'll work as directed by the committee on any issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Honourable Minister. You are now released. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Honourable Members, we now going to be dealing with the minutes of the last meeting. We only have one set of minutes. Is that correct?
We have two sets of minutes, Chair.
Oh yes, because we had a meeting in the morning and then a meeting in the afternoon. Yeah, on Ascoa. Yes, you're right.
Chairperson?
Yes, Honourable Lodge?
I would ask if I can be excused. I've got an important meeting that I need to attend in my own province, party political work. Since we've done with the content of today, the minutes I'm sure you will be able to handle without me.
Okay. Can I check if we still have a quorum, Ms. Grace?
Okay, Chair. Yes, we still have a quorum, Chair. We can.
All right. Thank you very much, Honourable Lodge. Thanks very much for your attendance and participation. You are excused.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. Can you scroll down, Mr. Pazia? Sorry, Ms. Fatima Ibrahim, if you wish to be excused, you can do so, because we're only dealing now with the minutes, but if you want to remain, it's fine still. So we don't want to keep you in the meeting, but it's up to you if you want to remain in the meeting. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Please, Nizulu, your mic is on. So, Tabandua. Thank you very much, Mr. Pazia. Honourable members, are there any corrections in the minutes? If not, can we have a mover and a seconder for the adoption of the minutes?
Thank you very much,
Chairperson. Honourable Moshori?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. I move for adoption of the minutes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any second there?
I'll second, Chairperson.
Thank you so much, Honorable Tango. The minutes have been moved and seconded. The next set, Mr. Bazia. And scroll down, Mr. Bazian. Thank you very much, Mr. Bazia. Any corrections on the minutes of the afternoon of the last Tuesday? Not. Can we then have a mover and a seconder for the adoption of the minutes? Honourable members?
I formally move, Chair, for the adoption of the minutes as two reflections.
Thank you so much, Honourable Mwimam. Any seconder?
I'll second, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Dango. The minutes have been moved and seconded, so the minutes have been adopted. Thank you so much, sir. Any announcement, Ms. Grace?
No, Chair. We don't have any announcement. We will forward the program to members.
Thank you so much.
And the department.
All right. Thank you very much, Honourable Members. This was our last meeting for the year. Thank you very much for the whole of 2023. Though I didn't start it on a good note because of due to ill health at the beginning of the year, I only started joining the committee on the 18th of April this year. But we continue very well with our meetings. I think they are reflected in the draft annual report, which will be adopting sometime next year. Thank you very much for your attendance, your participation, your cooperation. So I'd like to thank the staff of the committee, as well as the staff of Parliament, communications unit, the procedural officer, Ms. Advocate Samara Ali, as well as all other members of the staff of Parliament for their assistance, and also to the constitutional and the legal service office for their advice when we are dealing with the legislation, and also to the all the department that we oversight and their entities we oversight as a committee. Also to PMG, we also sometimes make use of the information, a lot of information that you find in the PMG website. We always make use sometimes. We even before some departments come, because most of them will first go to the PC, the portfolio committee. I would just sometimes go and check what is it that the department were presenting to the portfolio committee. But some of the committees, unfortunately, are locked, that of the PC. You have to subscribe before you have access to such committees, which is a bit of a disappointment on my part. Sometimes I would like to find out what is the PC has been discussing with regard to DTIC. It's one of the areas that are locked, employment and labor, transport is locked there. You can access the information. Anyway, we also like to thank PMG as well as other media and our communication unit, as we've already said, for also making sure that the public is involved. They use the social media, the 48 the TV channel. Thank you very much, honorable members. Though we will be seeing each other this afternoon in the plenary session, which is the final address. That will be done by the Honourable Deputy President, with also speakers from the provinces, such as premiers and other MSCs who will be staying in for premiers from their provinces. Thank you very much. Those that we won't be able to see in the plenaries, we wish everybody a festive season. Hope to see each other in the new year. Thank you so much. And goodbye to everybody.
Can we just thank the chair for his attitude and his devotion to work and continuity in keeping us all on our toes. Thank you very much, Chair. Wish you well for the new year and for the end of this year, and good health forever. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Thank you to Lufelu, Saroj, and the other PLOs. Thank you so much. The meeting is adjourned. Honorable members, goodbye. See you in the afternoon.
Mr. Grimson.
Bye, Chair.
Bye-bye.
Long live the church.
Thank you.
Bye, Chair.